Yeah, that one, I guess. The problem on homework 13 where you have to, you gave us that the circle that is radius k squared encloses, like how many ever points that circle encloses.
Ah, mm-hmm, yep.
Has the energy levels for that, and then you asked us to come up with a way to do that in three dimensions, kind of. And like, where do you start?
So, for the three-dimensional particles in a box, we had a k vector that was pi nx divided by lx, pi ny divided by ly, pi nz divided by lz, right? And the corresponding energy was h bar squared k squared over 2m squared. So if we think about what values are going to work, they're a lattice in space. So we have all of these little boxes. It's easier done in two dimensions. We have all of these little three-dimensional boxes that each one of which would contain one state.
Okay.
Right. So we make a little box that has a side in the kx direction is given by that dimension, and the ky direction is given by that dimension, and the kz is given by that dimension. So each one of those little boxes has a state, and all we have to do is to count the number of boxes that are inside a k sphere. Well, we can start by calling it k. So the volume of an octant like that is going to be 1/8 of 4/3 pi k cubed, and the size of one of these boxes is going to be the product of all of those dimensions. Right? So that's going to give me approximately the number of boxes that would fit inside that octant. Right? The boxes are square and the surface is round, so it's going to be some sort of approximation at the surface. But pretty much, that's going to give you the number of states. So this is the number of states that have energy less than the corresponding value of k. And we can rewrite k in terms of energy, right? Because from this we know that 2me divided by h bar squared square root is equal to k. So this thing is all proportional then. The number of states that have an energy less than some e is less than e to the 3/2 power.
Why is it e to the 3/2?
Because it was k cubed, right? So it's really just a repetition of what we did in two dimensions, except now we've got three. So instead of the area of a quarter of a circle, we've got the volume of 1/8 of a sphere. Each state takes a given amount of area or volume, depending upon which case we're in. And we can count then the number of states by counting the volume. It's not literally an exact count, of course, because the boxes are going to make a box, you know, a Lego version of a sphere, right? You happy? You're still cogitating.
So the pi over LX, LY, LZ things, those are like the sides of the
Those were the sides of the box, right? Because each if I change n by 1, the corresponding k value changes by this dimension. And this was the story, of course, because the function was the sines, right? We needed to have zeros when we reached the edge of the box. Got it. So you'll be doing the next thing, the same thing next semester. When you in statistical mechanics, it's really important to be able to count these states. So you'll see the same argument there. More questions? Well, so last time we were kind of 50-50. Half the time we were talking about this handout where we were looking at the states and the wave functions that we had for the three cases we've talked about. Infinite spherical square well, simple harmonic oscillator, and the hydrogen atom. And I don't know, there are lots of things we talked about. Kind of the beginning statement is that we could describe the energies in terms of the number of radial nodes, NR, and kind of the number of angular modes. And we could then display them in this two-dimensional graph corresponding to that. For any value of L, these were all isotropic problems, so for any value of L, there was a degeneracy that corresponded to having basically the same solution oriented in a different pattern. So that changing in orientation with the same number of overall number of modes on the sphere is changing the value of M, the Z component of angular momentum. It's worth noting that the H atom is a special case because notice that there we have a degeneracy on this graph. We have lots of these two levels have the same energy, even though they have different values of N and L. Right? So the thing that determines the energy is the sum of NR and L, so we can decrease R by 1 and increase L by 1, and we have exactly the same energy. So there's additional degeneracy in the case of the hydrogen atom. If we look at the spacing, then the spacing is important because we can measure it, right? Because we measure the energy of photons that are given up when we get a transition between these states. If we look at the simple harmonic oscillator, the spacing is uniform, and that corresponds to the fact that the classical frequency is the frequency, right? The frequency doesn't depend on amplitude. Any sort of oscillation in an oscillator has the same frequency. So the spacing is going to be the same. There are not a lot of states here, but it is in fact the case that if we look at the spacing for the square well, the energy differences are getting larger as we go to higher and higher energy. So that means classically that we have a higher frequency if we have higher energy, and that should make sense. We have this particle that's bouncing around inside this bag. If we give it more energy, it's all kinetic energy, so it's going faster, it still has the same distances to travel. So the frequency is going to increase when we increase the energy. For the hydrogen atom, more energy corresponds to larger orbits, and larger orbits have longer periods, which is to say lower frequencies. So that's why these levels all get crunched together here at the top. We have small spacing, low frequency classically when we have correspondingly high energy. And I don't know, it's maybe worth reminding you about what these classical orbits look like. The circular orbits have the maximum amount of angular momentum for a given amount of energy. The energy just depends on the semi-major axis, which is basically the big radius for the ellipse. So these two guys, at least approximately, have the same energy because they have the same semi-major axis. The one that is the most eccentric, large eccentricity, has the smallest value of the angular momentum. It's essentially a radial orbit. So these S orbits are cases where we have a wave that is just moving radially, and as we add more angular momentum, we get some motion that's going around the nucleus. So questions about this stuff? Did you get a printout of this one way or the other? I think it's all online too.
Yeah.
So then we get the kind of complicated questions about spin. And I'm never sure what the best way is to talk about spin. A short and true, and I think not helpful statement, is that it all comes from relativity. So if you do the relativistic quantum mechanics, you find out that the electron automatically has spin 1/2, and everything you want to know about it is a consequence of relativity. But historically, that's not how people thought about this. They thought about a spinning electron in the same context that they thought about a spinning molecule. Yeah, if you remember your classical mechanics, spinning objects are mathematically difficult. So we need some more coordinates, right? So the location of the center of mass of something is going to be described by our usual x, y, and z. But now we need coordinates to describe the orientation of this object. And turns out there isn't a really happy way to do this. The usual way to do this is with three Euler angles. But, you know, if you go through the work, you can write down what the spin angular momentum is in terms of these Euler angles. And you're going to get angular momentum operators that have ugly derivatives of those Euler angles. And, you know, you can go to town on figuring out what the solution to Schrodinger's equation for those ugly operators. In the case of spherically symmetric objects, it's moderately simple. The kinetic energy is just the total angular momentum divided by the common moment of inertia. Everything would have the same moment of inertia. But if we're talking about more complicated shapes, it quickly becomes a mess. Well, even in the simplest cases, it's pretty much a mess. But the main point is we don't have to know any of that, or we can often get away without knowing any of that, because the spin angular momentum is angular momentum, and it's going to satisfy this commutation relation. And this is all we needed to find those states. As soon as we assumed this, we automatically got that that there were two L plus one states, and we had these ladder operators that connected them. We didn't actually have to solve Schrodinger's equation in order to answer lots of questions. Now, it doesn't answer all of the questions. So if you wanted to know what the velocity was of a hydrogen atom in a spinning methane molecule, if you really cared about that particular coordinate, then you'd have to go through the mess. But for the electron, we can't see the pieces. And I would go so far as to say is the pieces don't exist. So it's not just that we're not too interested in the internal coordinates. It's that they're fundamentally unmeasurable. So we should be able to do everything we need to do just with the symbol that represents that complicated function. So we just use orthonormality of these things. We use the usual properties of raising and lowering operators. And we can answer all questions that are actually measurable about electrons. But historically, how people came at this is, again, from the idea that an electron was like a molecule. So the only thing that's different is that I can make this can spin fast or slow. And I can't change the spin rate of an electron. It's fixed. And part of that may just be semantics. That is to say, electron is pretty small, and that's kind of mr squared. So if you plug in reasonable numbers for what the moment of inertia is of an electron, you come up with that kinetic energy is comparable to the rest mass of the electron. So if we had a particle that was spinning, you know, twice as fast as an electron, but had a mass that was three times the mass of an electron, we wouldn't call it an electron. We'd give it a new name. And that's exactly what we do with the proton, where there are faster spin versions of protons, and we just give them new names because they have radically different masses. Okay, but I repeat, it sure looks as if... there is no evidence that the electron isn't a fundamental particle and so can't spin faster than it is spinning. Lots of people believe, and I have hopes, that that's not the case, that there is something inside of an electron, something more fundamental. But people have been working on it now for a century and have made no progress. So maybe it is, in fact, fundamental. You'd be hard pushed to find a theorist who actually thinks that, though. Everyone has hopes. Nobel Prizes to be won. Questions? Okay, so We now so I don't know if the spin of an electron is maybe weird enough, but now we get to even weirder stuff that I kind of can't overestimate the importance of it. It's really useful stuff, and it kind of seems like magic, but it is fundamentally, at its core, it's pretty easy. It's just getting there that is not much fun. And the topic we're talking about is combinations of angular momentum. And maybe the first question to answer is, you know, this is not going to be a fun trip, so why go on it? And the answer is that in the end, we're trying to get easy answers to this sort of question. And if we can find degeneracy, we can get lots of solutions basically for free. So we're really interested in degenerate cases. Because you get lots of bang for your buck, right? For one solution of Schrodinger's equation, we find 2L plus 1 solutions. So it's a big force multiplier if we can figure out what the degeneracy is. And we've said that degeneracy is related to symmetry. So in this case here, we had spherical symmetry, and we've said that angular momentum was the thing that in some sense generated rotations. But if we think about something like the planetary system, just because it's big enough to hold in our hands, we have both planets spinning and we have planets with orbital angular momentum. And generally speaking, planets' spin angular momentum is roughly aligned with their orbital angular momentum. The Earth is spinning more or less the same direction it's rotating about the Sun. It's not true of all planets, but it's true with the majority of planets. And kind of the question is does that matter? If I were to rotate the Earth's orbit and not rotate the Earth's spin axis, would that leave the system exactly the same? Or just approximately the same? And the answer is, it turns out there is an interaction between spin and orbital angular momentum. And if we want to have exactly the same system, we have to rotate both of them by exactly the same angle, and then we're back to just a rotated version of the same thing. So if L rotates the center of mass coordinates, we also need to have spin to rotate the spin coordinate. And so it's going to be the L plus S symmetry that's going to be important. It's the thing that's actually going to have the degeneracy. So I don't know, that's one sort of argument to make. Another sort of argument to make is, you know, from 191, you show that if there are no external torques, it's the total angular momentum that's going to be conserved. And conservation laws tie into what commutes with the Hamiltonian, and therefore what generates symmetries. So we're really going to want to make angular momentum operators that are made out of the sum of, say, orbital angular momentum and spin. And the key point is that given we know that these guys satisfy this sort of commutation relation with L's instead of S's, and these guys, by definition, satisfy that same sort of commutation relation, and we can show that J automatically will then also satisfy those same commutation relations. And the key point is that L and S commute. Right? Because this thing here, if we want to adopt this sort of point of view, it has to do with derivatives of the Euler angles of the planet. And this thing here has to do with derivatives of the XYZ position of the planet. Right? So just as derivatives of X commute with derivatives of Y, they're totally different, these two guys are going to commute. So if we work through, for example, what Jx is commuted with Jy, when we commute those two guys, we're going to get I h bar Lz. These two guys commute, so they're going to give us zero. These two guys commute, so they're going to give us zero. These two guys, when they commute, are going to give us an I h bar Sc. So the sum angular momentum satisfies exactly these same commutation rules. And all that was necessary for proving all of the technology we have about these states just depended upon these commutation rules. So it must be that J is a operator which J, for which J squared has eigenvalues H bar squared, what I called L, I'll call J now, some integer or half integer, and Jz has eigenvalues that are H bar Mj. So I can automatically know what the eigenvalues are for this new operator J. And classically, we have some ideas about what the total angular momentum should be for this sum. It's going to depend on the orientation. So kind of at best, if we have L units of angular momentum of orbit and S units of angular momentum for spin, the best we could do would be to have J equal to L plus S. But we could also, of course, have them pointing in opposite directions, in which case the total angular momentum would be L minus S. So we're thinking that the total angular momentum, J, can actually range between L plus S and L minus S, and every integer in between those two possibilities. Okay. So here I've been thinking about electrons or planets, but let's, you know, for the record, think about some other cases where the same thing is going to be true. If we have two particles, say we're thinking about a helium atom, so we're going to have angular momentum of the first electron plus angular momentum of the second electron. And of course, separately, these guys satisfy these commutation relations, right? They're angular momenta. And this guy has to do with derivatives of the location of the first particle, and this guy has to do with derivatives of location of the second particle. They're going to commute. So automatically, this total angular momentum is going to satisfy these commutation relations. And automatically, we can say that the eigenvalues of the total angular momentum are going to have this sort of behavior. And we can use ladder operators to move between the two possibilities. Okay, same thing said differently. If we have two isolated electrons, they have, each one has their own spin, but this guy has to do with the coordinates of particle one, this guy has to do with the coordinates of particle two. They commute, so automatically the total spin operator is going to satisfy this relationship. Okay. So let's briefly go back to thinking about orbital angular momentum. So if we have two electrons in helium, say, if we want to have a symmetry, we really have to change the location of both of those, right? So we would expect that the Hamiltonian is going to commute with this full rotation operator, right? If we just move one and not the other, then we change the separation between those two particles, and there's an interaction between them, right? They both have charge, so E squared over the distance between those two particles has changed, So it's going to be a different situation if I rotate just one. So I expect that the Hamiltonian will commute with the capital L operator, and therefore I will automatically have degenerate states given the different possible orientations of the total angular momentum operator. Now, if I ignore the interaction between those electrons, then the distance between them doesn't matter, and then I would expect this guy to commute with the Hamiltonian and this guy to commute with the Hamiltonian separately. And I would have degeneracies due to those qualities. Okay, so it depends, right? It depends if there's interactions between the two particles. Well, so it's pretty much impossible that there's no interactions. But it's often useful to, if the interaction is small, it's often useful to use that as a starting point. So when we think about planetary motion, usually we think about these orbits as being not related to each other, right? We can calculate the orbit of Earth, we can calculate the orbit of Jupiter. We know in our hearts that there is an interaction between the Earth and Jupiter, but it's small, and as long as we don't crank forward a whole lot in time, we can figure out where the Earth is going to be, just assuming that Jupiter and the Earth don't interact, that we just have a usual Keplerian orbit. Okay, so it's usually an approximation that there's zero interaction between two particles, but it's often a useful approximation. It might also be useful to talk about a case where there isn't symmetry and where this is not a particularly useful thing to do. So if we think about a spinning electron in an external magnetic field, the potential energy is minus the magnetic dipole moment plotted into that magnetic field. If I change the orientation of that spin, I've changed the energy. So it's not a symmetric state in terms of rotation, right? The magnetic field the external magnetic field vector gives a specified direction that breaks the isotropic nature of things. Okay, so we need some sort of symmetry to make this useful. Symmetry is generating the degeneracy, and the degeneracy is giving us a big lever on finding solutions. Okay, so that's why we're doing this. We're hoping for symmetric problems, and the sum of these angular momentum vectors is going to rotate everything together, which sounds like a much more likely situation to generate a symmetry, as opposed to just moving one. So let's take a look at maybe the simplest possible example. Two isolated electrons and their interaction. So first of all, if we just think about two electrons that are next to each other, there is going to be some interaction, right? This guy is going to make a magnetic field, and this guy is going to be responding to that magnetic field. What is the nature of that interaction? Well, we could write down answers, but if you think about it, something like that is probably the right answer. And that answer already has lots of good features, right? It doesn't depend on the absolute orientation of either S1 or S2, right? It depends on the relative. So if I rotate both S1 and S2, I'm going to have exactly the same energy. I'm going to have the same sort of situation. So this is a hopeful situation for the total spin being a useful quantum number. Dot product. Okay, so what we need to do in order to solve this problem, of course, we've made it simple. I'm talking about electrons, so there's only two states for each electron. So there are a total of four states, product states. And I could write these things like that, right? Specifying that it has a total angular momentum 1/2 and that is oriented up. But takes a whole lot of symbols in order to do that. And all of the information is really just in this number here, right? Because I can't change this number. If it's an electron, it has a spin 1/2. So the only important number is whether it's spinning up or down. So the book, not uncommonly, uses that notation, but that still requires four keystrokes. And it's not, to me, it's not very mnemonic. I like this notation, right, which requires two keystrokes, right? Line like that, a line like that. And it's self-explanatory, right? It's spin up. And the other case is spin down. Now, one disadvantage of this is it's super simplified. And you have to remember that it really, something more complicated is really sitting behind that simple thing. So if we adopt this sort of point of view, this thing is really a function of these Euler angles. But I'm hoping never to have to know what that function is. I'm hoping that I'll just be able to answer things by using the raising and lowering operators in order to get my answers out. Okay, so it's just an arrow up, but it's really a whole state, a whole wave function, which we're hoping never to have to, hoping and in fact never will write down. Okay, so I've got four possibilities, four possible states. I could have the first electron up, and I could have the second electron up, and I'll use that notation. The first arrow indicates the spin of the first particle, and the second indicates the spin of the second particle. I could have this one up and this one down, or I could have this one down and this one up, or I could have them both down. Right? Four states. Two choices for the first, two choices for the second, 2 times 2 is 4. And what I need to do is to figure out what happens when the Hamiltonian operates on these states. And of course, what I'm looking for is cases where I just get a constant back times that same state, right? That's an eigenfunction of the Hamiltonian. And whatever is inside the parentheses is the corresponding energy. Okay, so now we come up with a really important trick. The plan is to express this dot product in terms of things that are easy, raising and lowering operators. Raising and lowering operators in general have inside this bracket something like this. And if you work through the numbers, it's actually just 1. So if I raise down, I get h bar up. And vice versa, if I lower up, I get down. And of course, these things have z component that is h bar over 2. So this one has z component that's minus h bar over 2. And ss plus 1 is 3/4. So if s squared operates on that state, I get that. So if I can express s1 dot s2 in terms of raising and lowering operators, it'll be golden, right? It's a case where I never need to know what these things are in terms of functions. And of course, what S1 dot S2 is it's S1x times S2x plus S1y, S2y plus S1z, S2z. So this is, you know, that's great. We know what those guys do. SX and SY, those things combine in terms of giving us the raising and lowering operators, right? So, for example, S1 plus is SX plus ISY, and S1 minus, oops, I should have put ones on all of those, is S1X minus IS1Y. And I'm hoping to express the non-circled part in terms of raising and lowering operators. And with those I, so you're used to seeing the difference of squares, but with those I's, sums can be differences of squares, right? So there's some hope that that I is gonna do its job. So let's check out if the following thing works. So let me take S1 plus times S2 minus and work out what it is. So this is going to be S1x plus S1y, and then S2x minus IS2y. Okay, so I've got this term here. That's looking good, right? I've got S1x times S2x. I needed that. And this term here is doing good too, because I times minus I is plus 1. So half of my terms are doing me good. Now, the other terms I'm not quite as happy about. If I take these two guys, what I'm going to get, I'm going to have an overall factor of I. Let me do this one first then. So I'm going to get S1y times S2x minus S1x S2y. And that may look a little bit like these commutation relations, but remember, 1 and 2 commute, right? Because they're different coordinates. So I can write those in any order I want, and it's not 0. However, if I do the reverse, S1 minus times S2 plus, all that does is change these signs around. And what that will do is exactly change these signs around. So I will get minus that same quantity. So if I take the sum of this and this, I get what I want twice. So this is the same thing as 1/2 of S1 plus S2 minus plus S1 minus S2 plus. And I know how those operators work. So I can calculate what those things do to one of my states. Okay, we're happy. So that's a main and important trick. So let's do it. So let's let, give myself some space. So let's let H operate on double up. That's the same thing as 1/2 of S1 plus S2 minus S1 minus S2 plus. And then we've got my SZs. And I want to figure out what all of that is going to do to double up. And the first thing to recognize is that when this guy tries to operate on this, it's going to give me 0. Because I can't raise up. So this term drops out. And same thing here. This guy can't be raised, so that guy's going to give me 0. So the only thing I'm going to get out of this in the end is the product of these two angular momentum. So the first one gives me h bar over 2. The second one gives me minus h bar over 2. They're eigenfunctions, so I still end up with the same thing. So what I've got here is minus h bar squared over 4. So one possible energy is minus h bar squared over 4. If you think about it, it works very much the same for the state double down. This term is going to give me 0. Wait, sorry, right? This is plus 2, right? So I can't lower down, and I can't lower down. So in the end, I'm going to get minus h bar over 2 times minus h bar over 2, double down. So I've got a degenerate state. Double up and double down both have an eigenvalue that is h bar squared over 4. Okay, so that was the easy case. Kind of no surprise, it's the other ones that are going to be more interesting. So if I have my Hamiltonian operate on up down, so the Hamiltonian is S1 plus S2 minus plus S1 minus S2 plus, and then we've got my product of those guys. So this guy is going to generate a 0 because I can't lower down. But the other term is going to work fine, right? Because I can lower this guy and I can raise that guy. And when this guy gets raised, I get one factor of h bar. And when this guy gets lowered, I get another factor of h bar. So from this term here, what I'm going to get, overall factor of a half, two h bars, and then I get the thing reversed. So it's not, whatever this is, it's not an eigenfunction, because on the right-hand side, I'm not going to have the same thing as I had when I started with. Okay. So over here, now I get the minus sign that I had before. The first one gives me h bar over 2, and the next one gives me minus h bar over 2. These guys are eigenfunctions of Sz, so I do get back what I started with that term. Okay. How about I let the Hamiltonian work on the other possibility? Okay, so now this one here is going to generate a zero, right? Because, well, actually, either one of those, take your pick, is going to generate a zero. I can't lower down and I can't raise up. So it's this term here that's going to do what I want, right? It's going to raise this arrow and it's going to lower that arrow. And it's going to generate an h bar each time it does it. So it's going to give me 1 half h bar squared, and then the opposite combination. Okay, and then here, one of them's positive, one of them's negative, so I get minus h bar squared over 4 times times what I started with. Okay, so we found two eigenfunctions, and we found two things that aren't eigenfunctions. But if we look carefully at what we've got, what happens if I just add up? So I take up and down, and I add it to down and up. So all I need to do is to add these two sets of possibilities. So in terms of that guy, what I'm going to get is 1 half minus a quarter. So I'm going to get 1 quarter of h bar squared down and up. And here, I'm going to also get a half minus a quarter. I'm going to get 1 quarter of h bar squared up and down. So this thing is an eigenfunction, right? Because I get back exactly what I started with. And I've erased it, but this is exactly the same eigenenergy we had for the other two. So I have three degenerate states that have exactly the same energy, h bar squared over 4. If I look at the other combination, then what am I going to get? So this is the one I wrote with plus, this is the one I wrote with minus. So I need to take minus this, and then these two terms are going to, this one is negative and this one is negative because I subtracted it. So what I'm going to get is 2 halves of it. And this one was positive. This one is going to be, am I happy with what I've got? Or did I do it backwards? I think I did it backwards, right? So I should have been subtracting this from that. So this one's minus, and this one's minus. Two minus a quarters are going to be minus a half. Okay, so now for the other state, I've got this guy minus this guy, so that's going to give me plus h bar squared over 2 down up. And I can factor this out again. minus h bar squared over 2 down up minus that. Okay, so the upshot is I found 3 states, each one of which had an energy that was h bar over 4, and I found 1 state that had an energy that was minus h bar squared over 2. And we did a fair amount of work in order to make this calculation. So let's see if we can do it an easier way. So what I have is I have an angular momentum that's 1/2 that's supposed to be added to an angular momentum that's 1/2. And from what we've said before, those angular momentums could be aligned, in which case I would get an angular momentum of 1, or they could be opposite, in which case I would get an angular momentum of 0. So these cases here, this thing would have an eigenvalue of total angular momentum squared. That would be h bar squared 1 plus 1. And this one here would have an eigenvalue of total angular momentum that would be 0. This one would come in 3 different states, right, where the total angular momentum in the z direction was 1, 0, or minus 1. And we would expect that those states would be degenerate, right? Because it's the total spin that commutes with that Hamiltonian. That sounds a lot like what we want, 3 plus 1. But how about getting the exact values? Can we get the eigenvalues out without doing any work? Well, we can, right? Because S1 dot S2, we can relate that to S1 plus S2 squared. So let's expand out S1 plus S2 squared. It's S1 squared plus S2 squared plus twice the dot product of S1 dotted with S2. And I remind you, usually we'd be concerned about the order of operations, but 1 and 2 are different coordinates. They're going to commute. So we can deal with them just as if they were normal numbers. So the Hamiltonian that we have, it's just equal to 1/2 the total spin squared minus the spin of each one of the electrons divided by 2. Now we know that the spin of the electrons is always 1/2. And so if we look at the spin of any particular electron, these guys are going to give us 3/4 of h bar squared, right? Each of them is going to give us 3/4 of h bar squared. This corresponds to a total spin of 1, so this guy is going to give us h bar squared 1 times 2. So twice 3/4 is 1/2. I subtract 1/2 from 2, I get 1/2. So the eigenvalue is going to be h bar squared over 4 for any of these states, right? Because none of these things depended upon the orientation of that spin. They only depended on the value. On the other hand, this guy here that has spin 0, we can't change the spin of electrons, so that piece isn't going to change at all. So here what we have are these two guys, each one of which is going to give us 3/4 of h bar squared. And we have twice that. That's not what I got before, right? I think I got minus 1/2 for the eigenvalue. So there must be a mistake in the in that version of it. So first let me correct the mistake. So what we had were things like 1/2 down and up, and then minus 1/4 up and down. And when I subtracted them, these guys came together. They had the same, the one that was below came together with this one. So it would have given us 3/4. So that's make that correction in your notes. Not 1/2, minus 3/4. Okay, so your question was, what happened to the...
When you did the case, it spins 0. Mm-hmm. You said that the first S squared goes to 0?
Yes, because what we always get for any angular momentum squared, it's going to be h bar squared LL plus 1, where L is whatever the angular momentum is. This one had angular momentum 0, so it's going to give us 0. When we put in the angular momentum of 1, that's when we got the 2. These guys, for each one of them, it was 1/2 and 3/2. That's how we got the 3/4. So the claim is, by learning how to put together these angular momenta, we can solve these sorts of problems a whole lot easier. You can always do them the long way. But if we can immediately write down things, it's pretty helpful. And while it's kind of a mess in order to actually find out what these coefficients are, in this case it was just the symmetric or anti-symmetric combination, but in general it's going to be more complicated. In order to find those combinations, it's in general a mess, but it's been done. Right? So if you look at this sheet, and we'll talk about how to use this sheet in the future, these things are the coefficients that you need in order to make something, given an angular momentum that is, say where you're adding angular momentum 3/2 to angular momentum 1, you go to the appropriate table here and you can find what coefficients you need in order to make that state. So in the particular case we were doing 1/2 added with 1/2, and you might notice that inside the square box there, what we have are the symmetric and the anti-symmetric combination. It is important to recognize what it says here, that these things are always square roots of something, so they don't bother to write the square root, but they may be plus or minus signed. So we don't mean to take the square root of the minus sign. We just take the square root of the number and we put the minus sign in front of it. Saves writing lots of square root signs. Okay, so that's the topic for next time. I hope you've seen that doing this allows us to answer questions quickly. And now we need to tabulate some of these, but once we've tabulated them, we're good forever.